Decade, Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk with chef and public TV host Patty Heenich on this week's edition of Food Friday. She'll share recipes and advice to help us make Mexican cuisine in our own kitchens. First, many Muslim Americans experience racism and Islamophobia, especially in the post-9/11 United States. It can be tough to grapple with a sense of identity and belonging in a country that isn't always welcoming. Our next guest shares his story of the challenges and absurdities, the positive moments, and the funny moments, too. Wajahat Ali was born and grew up in California, the child of Pakistani-American immigrant parents. He tries to use humor to cope with discrimination and to tell the story of his experience finding himself in the United States. And he says alongside the challenges, he feels a lot of hope. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or your family had experiences with Islamophobia or racism? What was it like? How do you see Muslim Americans treated in your neck of the woods? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Wajahat Ali is a playwright, a columnist for The Daily Beast, co-host of the Democracy-ish podcast, and author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. Wajahat, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You've got no shortage of stories to tell in your life story, from awkward childhood moments to near-death experiences and more. What led you to want to put it all down in memoir-ish form?
Yeah, memoirish. I like that. The story, Go Back to Where You Came From, is about loving a country that doesn't always love you back. And I consider it an elegy for the rest of us who oftentimes are seen as the co-protagonists, sidekicks, villains, or we're completely erased from the story and just treated as footnotes. And I thought in this moment in time, there might be an opening, Rob, where fellow Americans might realize, these people of color, these immigrants, these marginalized folks, they're not lying about this thing called white supremacy and racism. They might be onto something. And all their warnings about our democracy being under attack and the fact that we might not have a multiracial democracy, there might be something here to it. So I thought this was a critical time where I could tell this story, my story, but connect it to the story of America right now, undergoing many atrocities and horrors as we are simultaneously doing this push and pull between nativist trends that have existed and the trend to push and expand this country to accommodate all of our children as its potential co-protagonists. So I thought the time was now.
Your parents laid out three career options for you, as I understand it. Doctor, engineer, or successful businessman. Not just businessman, successful businessman. How did you develop your superpower as a writer and storyteller?
Well, yeah, the fourth option is failure. So you forgot failure.
I forgot failure. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's what I call the immigrant checklist of success. It's not just South Asian parents, but it's basically, hey, we came to this country. We left behind everything. We didn't leave behind everything for you to become an English major. And, you know, we want stability and security for you. And we want the dreams that you can't have. So you have to be a doctor or an engineer or a dubious businessman or a businesswoman who somehow makes a lot of money and he marries well and has 2.1 kids and gets a nice house and gets either a Toyota Acura or a BMW. And, you know, my parents, being Pakistani immigrant parents, very traditional. We always joke that they brought the boat inside the home. Like, they didn't burn the boat. They brought the boat inside the home. First of all, they named me Wajahat, obviously to blend. They didn't teach me English growing up, because who needs English in the Bay Area, California, right? Eh. And they said, you'll learn. But they were very supportive of my artistic talents. So I wrote a story at the age of 10. I mentioned this in the book. And a one-page short story became a 10-page short story. And being the shy, awkward, brown, sweaty kid who wore husky pants, who used to get bullied by his classmates, my teacher said, get up and read this story. And I'm like, please don't make me do it. She goes, get up and do it. And for the first time ever, they were rapt with attention. They didn't mock me. They laughed at all the right parts and they applauded. And that's when I kind of discovered I might have a superhero talent. I might be able to tell a story. And I took that story home to my father, who was drinking chai. He says, beta, which means son, you might have a talent here. You might think about becoming a writer. And my mom ran from the kitchen and said, first become a doctor, which is just insurance, right? My mom was like, just have insurance. But I was very lucky, Rob, that my parents were very untraditional in that they always supported and nurtured the talent. And many children of immigrants don't have that support or that encouragement, and which is why they become doctors and engineers, but secretly very unhappy.
a running theme through the book is, you know you have a lot of identities, awkward kid, writer, later father. I could go on with that list for a long time. When seen from the outside, especially I think after September 11th, other people, mainly white people, looked at you and saw what?
Osama, Saddam, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, suspect, other, terrorist, potential terrorist, helper of terrorists, potential radical terrorist who might not be a terrorist. Oh, look, a smiling terrorist. It's very interesting that all of us have complex identities, but oftentimes people are of color are the only ones who are hyphenated or have the asterisks, right? And in 9/11, as I mentioned in the book, for many of us, especially those immigrants, children of immigrants, people of color, who grew up as the model minority stereotype, a stereotype I hope to demolish in the book, you know, we thought we were American, born and raised in this country, right? Yeah, sure, we don't see ourselves on the billboards or on the cover of the magazines, but we are American. We identify. But overnight, after 9/11, all of a sudden we became us and them, you know, a terrorist or a suspect. And overnight from that moment on, me, Wajhat Ali, a Muslim brown kid from California, had to represent and defend 1,400 years of Islamic civilization and 1.8 billion Muslims. And no matter what I did, as Toni Morrison said, that's the exhaustion of racism. It's never enough. You always have to prove your worth, and it's never enough because this nameless judge, jury, and executioner always holds your loyalty, moderation, and patriotism as suspect.
We're talking to Wajhat Ali, author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. You can join in with your questions if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you've experienced some of what Wajhat was just talking about, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. The title, Go Back to Where You Came From, you write right off the bat, this is something you've heard, been emailed, you're active on social media, you've certainly encountered in there. Like, what do you do with that when somebody, especially in person, when somebody says that to you? I don't know what I would do.
Yeah, you know what's so interesting is the title of the book is like a gut punch, right? And the book begins with emails that I receive every day. And I just copy paste the emails. And the first email is, go back to where you came from. I get it almost every day in some aspect, some form. And it's interesting is that for me, I'm so used to it and people of color are so used to it. But there are many readers in the past month, such as yourself, like, oh, my God. This happens to you every day? Wow. How would I respond? And it just shows you how it is for the rest of us who, even though we're born and raised in this country, are told to go back. So it's how you respond. And so how I respond in the book is like Bugs Bunny. You know, Bugs Bunny is chased by Elmer Fudd and Yosemite Sam, but he uses their own traps against them and sometimes kisses them on the cheek. And at the end, he gets the last laugh, the last word, and he gets the carrot. And so I respond by saying, would you like me to go back to the Bay Area? I'd love to if you could subsidize the rent. Or, oh, are we all going back to the womb? Okay, Freud. Or, do you want me to go back to pre-partition India? Because my parents, even my mother wasn't born in India. She was born in Pakistan. And that type of response with some humor is a response, but also kind of dismantles the stupidity and the bigotry of that comment, right? Where apparently the rest of us are here as conditional citizens, and our citizenship and our home loan application and our mortgage can be revoked at any second based upon our ethnicity. And the real American, Rob, apparently the one who was from here, is the white American who, by the way, wasn't from here. It actually belonged to the indigenous Americans, the Native Americans. So it's an ugly sentiment that has been told even to white Americans who weren't once considered white. And if you know your history, I'm talking about Italians, the Irish Catholic, Eastern European Jews, and the Germans. We were all told at one point to go back to where we came from.
Right. But I wonder how you think that, if that's going to change over generations. Like, my family goes back to Poland and Ireland, some other places. You wouldn't know that unless I told you or you did my family, my genealogy or whatever. I just read as white now. You are, second generation, your kids, third generation. Do you worry that because of the skin color difference, that's never going to go away?
Yeah, that's a question I address in the book. You know, that's the test of America. Whether or not America will succeed as a multiracial democracy will be whether or not people like me are considered American or my children are considered American. I'll give you an example. Who's been here since the founding? Black folks. Are they still considered American? Nope, still hyphenated. Latinos? Nope, still hyphenated. Mexicans, indigenous Americans, right? With you and your family, you mentioned Polish and Irish, double whammy, both hated back in the day. but you were able to be absorbed into what I call in the book whiteness. And I'm not talking about white people. With whiteness, it's this paradigm, this structure, this ideology that says those who are considered white or labeled white, which is a social construct, are elevated above all others and are seen as the true inheritors of this country called America, right? Where they have the manifest destiny to come birth this country from savagery and bring forth civilizations. But you are able to be absorbed into whiteness because you look quote unquote white. Again, a social construct, even though you weren't considered white like 100 years ago. Irish were not considered white. But how about the rest of us who don't look quote unquote white, even though we've been here even longer? That's the test, right? That's the test, because Black folks, people of color, will never be absorbed into whiteness ever. So will we dismantle this ideology of supremacy and have true equality? Or will we double down and fight for it and burn the country down? That's the test for the next 20 years.
We're talking to Wajhat Ali about his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with writer and author Wajhat Ali about his new memoir, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. Wajhat, you think a lot about the portrayal of Pakistani Americans, Muslim Americans in pop culture. I want to take you to a moment. You were younger. Your first kind of breakthrough as a writer was this play you wrote about a Pakistani American family. You're in talks to maybe bring it to LA, and an agent says, "Hey, maybe as the Pakistani American dad, what do you think of Ted Danson?"
Yeah, and I laughed, and there was no other laughter on the other end, and I'm like, "Wait, you're serious?" And he said, "Yeah, Americans like Ted Danson." I'm like, "Who doesn't like Ted Danson? I love Ted Danson. I love Cheers. I also like Becker. I also saw him in Gulliver's Travels." But this is a story about a Pakistani American family, and the father, Salman, is a middle-aged Pakistani man who goes, "Well, think about Ted Danson." And this was, you know, the play, The Domestic Crusaders. I started writing as a senior at UC Berkeley after 9/11 upon the suggestion and recommendation of my teacher, Ishmael Reed, who's a MacArthur Genius winner. And he, as a Black man, said, "Listen, we've been fighting back for 400 years. Art and culture is how we fight back and tell our stories. Your people, I'm looking at the news right now after 9/11, your people are going to get hazed for 10 years. He was wrong. It's been 20 years. But he said, "I've never seen an American story, a kitchen drama story, told from a perspective of, you know, like Muslims or Pakistanis. Write a story like that." And so that story, I had to do it myself, Rob, because I was told 20 years ago, the mainstream will never accept an ethnic story. Translation, white people will not accept a story of brown and Muslim folks. Take away all the ethnic stereotypes and take away all the ethnic mirch and the masala and make it easy and palatable. I proved them wrong. We did it ourselves. And I just want to flex for a moment. This play that was rejected and mocked and ridiculed 6 months ago, 20th anniversary of 9/11, it was republished by McSweeney's, with a foreword by Hasan Minhaj and a new conversation between me and Ishmael Reed and Carla Blank. And the play is being taught in schools. The play has been performed around the world. The play is being sold. And so sometimes you just have to do it yourself, have faith in your story, and have faith that the mainstream will come along.
Let's bring on a caller now. Stephanie is with us in Milwaukee. Stephanie, hi.
Hi. I had a comment and also a question. I'm really interested in this topic. I'm a psychology graduate student, and I'm really interested in intersectionality and cultural humility and working with clients. And then just from my experience, I think that it's really helpful to talk about these things, but there are some kind of things that make it difficult for people to talk about it. So my question is, how are some like maybe general ways that can be really good to talk about these things with people, but also with children, because I work with a lot of children, to just talk about this like in a more open way so that we can talk about our different backgrounds, but also talk about difficult kind of topics and how we can talk in a more like inclusive way, including everyone in this conversations that are very important. Thank you.
Stephanie, thanks. A couple big questions there, Wajhat.
Yeah, look, I have three kids. My kids are age 7, 5, and 2, and my wife and I have this conversation all the time, is because you simultaneously want to infuse in them the sense of pride in their culture and their skin color and their tone, especially, which is under assault right now in America, and their religion. But at the same time, you don't want them to be chauvinists also, right? Or restrictive or reactionary. And we live in a diverse community in Virginia. And so their classmates are different skin tones and different ethnicities and national origins. So what we say is, listen, this is who we are. You know, you're Pakistani American. This is your name. You're Muslim. But listen, at the same time, we live in a country where there's different people, there's different setups, there's different families. And as such, be respectful to everyone. And so what we do is we have had faith in them and their intelligence. So we talk to them. We talk to them at their level. We explain it to them. They're very curious. They understand. I'll give you an example. Even during the pandemic, we explained to them, this is why we're doing lockdown. This is why we're doing virtual school. There is a pandemic. This is COVID. This is why we wear masks. This is why we wash our hands. My children, ages 7, 5, and 2, Rob, wear masks, social distance, right? Clean their hands and understand the reason why they're doing it is to protect themselves and other folks. So even when it comes to topics about racism and culture and diversity and colorism, which we have to deal with if you're brown and black, because light skin tone is still the preferred skin tone. And my poor 5-year-old daughter, a couple of months ago, I wrote a New York Times article about this. She looked in the mirror and she said, oh, I wish I was light skin tone. That's beautiful. And I was like, no, everything we've done for 5 years, it's failure. And so we just doubled down and instead, you know, reaffirmed her beauty, her brownness, her brown skin tone, and said there's different colors there. But, you know, you are brown and you're beautiful, just like someone who's white or black is beautiful, but this is who you are. So when you're a brown and black person in this country, you are forced to have these uncomfortable conversations about racism, right, and colorism. And I'll just say that really quickly because oftentimes we're having this conversation, and, oh my God, our children, they can't tolerate these conversations. We have to protect them. I'm like, I was confronted with this at the age of 5 when I was dropped off at preschool and someone said, your skin color is the color of poo. Kids are dealing with this stuff, and it's up to us as parents to actually engage them and give them the right language and the right type of empathy and kindness, and also have faith in them that, listen, you know, this is the world we live in, and these are some of the values that we have, and you can be proud of who you are, but you also have to live in a community of diversity and understand that other folks have different lifestyles as well. And so that's how we've tried to model it. We just go straight in. We talk to them, we treat them with intelligence and sensitivity, and they get it. The kids get it.
Thanks for that call, Stephanie. We're talking to Wajahat Ali. His new book is Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. Wajahat, I hope you don't mind if I spoiled the ending a little bit. You come out with a full endorsement of the power of hope. And as a dad, the story you tell to back that up really hit me. Can you share the story of your daughter and how people came together to give you this hope?
Yeah, the last chapter of the book is called Invest in Hope, but Tie Your Camel First, which is based on this beautiful saying in Islam that's, yeah, have faith in God, but tie your camel first, which means do everything within your power to fix your situation. And after you've done that, you know, there's nothing else you can do except have faith. And, you know, having hope is very dangerous oftentimes in hopeless times because it means exposing yourself to the possibility that when the page turns, it brings a better story. But oftentimes we're met with what? Pain, disappointment, betrayal, regret. And so it's easier to curl up and have your shields go up and be defensive and cynical and apathetic, right? But like I said in the book, that often requires zero investment and means being a spectator. You know, being in the ring of life means exposing yourself to pain. And that was really brought to the forefront with my daughter's diagnosis 3 years ago, where she was diagnosed 8 months before the pandemic with stage 4 liver cancer, all over the liver with a cancer speck in her lungs. And we're like, we didn't know she'd survive. And we needed a full liver transplant and time was running out. And with the power of storytelling, I shared Nuseiba's story, and over 500 people, mostly strangers, stepped up to potentially be a liver donor for a girl they had never met, including people who told me they hated my politics, but they wanted to save a little girl. And finally, this one anonymous donor who later revealed himself to be Sean Zaheer, who coincidentally lived close by, decided, oh, let me go give a piece of my liver to this little girl. And this little girl survived because a community came together to rally around a little girl who had stage 4 cancer. You know, we raised the funds, raised the word, got an anonymous donor, Sean Zaheer, and now Nuseiba is in the next room, dressed up in one of her many costume changes of the day, Rob. You know, cancer-free, healthy, living her best life. And, you know, she's still immunosuppressed during a pandemic. But, you know, throughout that journey, I imagined what would happen if she passed away, if she prepared myself as a parent, right? Mm-hmm. So I imagined it and I steeled myself with these possibilities. But there was also another narrative where she lived. And she lived to be happy and healthy and married and have kids. And I chose to invest in that story.
Do I remember this right? Sean Zaheer, the person who had donated a chunk of liver to your daughter, his question on waking up is, Doc, when can I donate blood next time?
Just that was his first question, and the doctor who operated on him, he started crying. He said, "Listen, I've done this a lot of times. That's the first time I've ever had a donor wake up and ask that question. Usually it's like, when can I get back to work? Am I safe? Am I healthy?" But he said, "Hey, when can I give blood again?" Because he's also a marrow and blood donor. And then he told me, he says, "You have a good man's liver in your daughter. You have a good man's liver in your daughter. You're very lucky."
And just our last minute, Wajahat, how can we follow his example? I don't know, how can we pick that path of hope and generosity over all the other stuff we know is out there?
In the final minute, I will say this. I often get told, "I'm nobody, Waj." And I'm like, some of my favorite people are nobody. I'm a nobody also. I think everyone has a superhero talent. Everyone has something. And the way you behave, the way you model yourself every day in your life, at home, at school, at work, can be a reflection of how you want this country to be. Run for school board, run for city council, go out to a church, do interfaith, give money to the right candidates, in your behavior, in your language, change it up to be more empathetic, more sensitive, and try to model this behavior for your children. Think about how that will impact future generations. At the end of the day, we can only control our own actions and our own intentions. And if we model that behavior, then you know what? That's the best way to go out.
Wajahat, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me.
Wajahat Ali is a columnist for the Daily Beast. He's a playwright. He was with us sharing his new book. It's called Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll take a look at Mexican cuisine with Patty Heenich, host of the PBS show Patty's Mexican Table. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a ruling on redistricting from the Wisconsin Supreme Court yesterday. In a 4-3 decision, the court approved electoral maps proposed by Governor Tony Evers. We'll find out how that could change the balance of political power in the state and how it compares to the other maps on the table. Now, when somebody says Mexican food, you might think of tacos, burritos, enchiladas, and tamales. While those are a big part of the story, they don't completely represent the full variety of Mexican cuisine. In this week's edition of Food Friday, we're listening back to a talk with Chef Patty Heenich about the full scope of Mexican food. She spent the past decade seeking out the culinary gems of her home country. Some of them are pretty well known in the U.S. Others are local specialties passed down through generations. Then she figured out how to make those recipes accessible to people outside of Mexico and put the results in her new book. You can find a couple of the recipes we'll be talking about today at WPR.org/Food Friday. And if you have something to share about Mexican food, we'd still love to hear about it. Is there a favorite dish you make at home or that you've tried while traveling? If you've lived in Mexico or your family has roots there, what do you remember about the cuisine? Do you have a recipe to share? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Patty Heenich is the host of Patty's Mexican Table on public television. Her new book is Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. Here's a listen to our conversation. Now, this book has been a literal journey. Can you talk about your travels around Mexico and what you were looking for this book?
Absolutely. So, yeah, many, many years in the making. So, I come from Mexico City, and I lived there all my life until I married my husband, moved to Texas, switched careers, after I had my two kids and went from political analysis to cooking. And ever since then, I've just made my life's mission to share everything and anything from Mexico, culture, food, ingredients, stories. And in this book, which is my most ambitious so far, I just went to find, everybody now knows guacamole, and so many things are in the American culinary lingo, like taco and taco Tuesday and taco night, and everybody seems to know birria these days. But in this book, I bring 150 50 classic recipes. Recipes that are heirlooms that have been passed on through generations that are treasured, and they may be from a little town or micro region or macro region, but most of these have not crossed the border. And I'm here to tell you, you love Mexican food already? Well, here's more. And this is going to enrich your weekly menus and your table and your family life. And I hope people love it as much as I do.
Patty, I grew up in a small Midwestern town. I got to say, well into my life, I had a pretty narrow view of what Mexican food was. And it's very slowly dawned on me. Mexico's really big. It has a lot of variety. Can you tell us just how much variety there is within Mexico?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm still in awe, Rob, to be honest. And the more I know and the more I travel and the more I go back, I'm continuously treading, you know, back and forth. And you think you know a place, I think I know a state, I think I know a region, and I go back to try those classics. And I come back and find those classics, and there's many more. There's new dishes, new ways to use ingredients, and people are also really going back and trying to recover or bring to the surface pre-Hispanic dishes and takes. And between the combination of regions, historical eras, and the creativity of Mexican cooks, there never seems to be enough new things to try. So I, you know, here you can find food from all of the country, and each dish has a story tied to it. And I really work so hard to bring these recipes to your kitchen in a way that they're accessible, doable, repurposable, and mostly that they will bring you something that you can try and you're going to say, I want to make this again. And for the people who try them, I'm hoping they're going to say, we want that recipe. And that when you share it, you're also going to be able to share stories.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Patty Heenich about her new book, Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for Patty or you want to share your favorite Mexican meal you've ever had, whether you grew up with it or whether you've encountered it as a tourist somewhere in Mexico, love to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Let's talk about ingredients a little bit, Patty. One thing I love in your book is you made it so that it's stuff mostly we could find in our local grocery store. And I want to start with tomatoes. I thought, oh, what kind of tomato is Patty going to point me toward? Roma tomatoes, which you could find pretty often, especially good ones in the summer. Why are Roma tomatoes one of your first choices if you're making a salsa?
Well, Roma tomatoes are just so juicy and fleshy and have a wonderful consistency for salsas and stews and soups. They're rich. I mean, I always advise people when you bring tomatoes into your home, if they're not super fully ripe, like bursting, you know, leave them in your kitchen counter and let them continue to ripen. And if you can't find Roma tomatoes, which I think are really the best for like saucy, messy food, which is like what I like, any tomatoes that you find at the store, just let them ripen. I'd rather you use a very ripe tomato that's not a Roma than a green unripe Roma. And if you can't find fresh tomatoes that you're loving, you know, say in the middle of winter, you can use a can of crushed tomatoes. And there's many recipes in my cookbook that call for fire roasted or charred or broiled or roasted tomatoes. And you can now find cans of fire roasted tomatoes. So it's all much more accessible and easy than when I first moved to the US, Rob. I mean, I swear 20 years ago, you were lucky if you found a fresh jalapeno. And I'm talking even in Dallas, Texas. These days, I guess it has to do not only with the demand of, you know, the American audience. People are so much familiar with Mexican food and ingredients that people don't only want to go out and eat tacos, but people want to make Mexican food at home. So that demand has helped, you know, increase the availability. And you can really find almost anything, if not in stores, online.
Let's check out, Patty, one of the recipes you shared with us. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. This one, I could see it going on a Thanksgiving side dish sort of table here. Green beans in corn sauce with pumpkin seeds. First of all, tell us where this recipe is coming from in Mexico.
Yes, that is one of my favorite recipes in the entire book, Rob. I'm so happy you chose that. And if you see the photo of that recipe, you see the stunning green beans, the chunky red tomato sauce on top, and the crushed pepitas. And you would think that a new modern chef came up with this vegan, you know, really regal dish. And this is a recipe that has existed in the Yucatan Peninsula in the state of Campeche for centuries. People have been making it in Mexico since pre-Hispanic times. And this is the beauty about classic recipes, that they stand the test of time. Of course, let me describe this recipe to you. It's green beans that you quickly sear. And after they started to brown, you pour over them a sauce that you make by pureeing fresh corn. If you don't find fresh corn, you can use thawed from frozen. You puree the corn with a little bit of fresh cilantro or epazote if you find it. And then you cook the beans in that corn sauce, and they've begun to crisp. And then they start cooking in this sweet corn sauce that becomes velvety and so creamy, and it starts to stick on the green beans. And then you take them out of the pan, and this is really less than 10 minutes. And then you top that with a chunky tomato salsa that you make in a snap. And you garnish that with ground or chopped toasted pumpkin seeds. The combination of flavors is just insane, because you have the green beans, you have that really velvety sweet corn sauce, you have the tart and almost sweet tomato sauce, and then the salty and nutty pumpkin seeds. And it is such a delight. It can be a side, it can be a main. People who are vegetarians or vegans are going to feel like you really spoiled them by giving them something so delicious and not just a boring side of, you know, just bland green beans. And this is a recipe that, of course, it's adapted in my cookbook so that you can make it in your kitchen. But this is a recipe that used to be made by having the ingredients in a pot and throwing in a rock that was heated until it was really just burning hot, and it was thrown in the pot, and that's how the ingredients used to cook. And these were talking about pre-Hispanic times. But this recipe has evolved, and it's been maintained, and it's been passed on through the centuries. And I feel so, you know, so much pride to be able to pass on these recipes so that other people outside of Mexico or Mexicans who aren't from the Yucatan Peninsula can get to know it. And it's, you know, the part of cooking that it's so beautiful, because it's communal. You know, these recipes are here before we get here, and these recipes will remain after we leave. So it's just an honor to be able to pass these on.
You can find that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Green Bay. Matt, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Patty, I love your show, and I love how it's evolved over the years. My question is, I'm from La Frontera, in Las Cruces, New Mexico, which is like a green chili capital of the United States. And when I learned how to make chile rellenos there, they were crispy and stuffed with cheese, and you would just serve them crispy and eat them with a fork. But since I've moved to Green Bay, we have a lot of people who make chile rellenos from poblanos, and they fry them up, but then they just drown them in tomato sauce. what is it like the chile rellenos? Why is it always drowned down in Central Mexico?
Is that a different regional approach, Patty?
Yeah, and that is such a great question. And in fact, in my new cookbook, Treasures of the Mexican Table, I have a few variations of the chile relleno. And I love that you're asking this question, Matt, because there's a universe of chile rellenos. So the chile rellenos that you're talking about, it's the most popular version. The poblano chiles that are large, chubby, can be super stuffed, and they're typically fire roasted, sweated, and peeled, just like the roasted pimientos, you know, that you use in Italian cooking. So the same thing, the same process is is done to poblano chiles, and then the chiles are stuffed either with melted cheese or with picadillo, which is a combination of ground meat cooked in tomato sauce and olives and raisins and almonds, or beans. And then that chile goes drowned in a rich tomato sauce. It can either go directly like that, or most traditionally, that chile that's stuffed goes battered in an egg batter, then fried, which is what you're talking about, and then dressed in that sauce. And I think that is one of the most beloved and the most well-known of Mexican chile rellenos from central Mexico and Puebla and regions that have a lot of Mexicans that have moved to the U.S. So I guess that's why it's becoming so popular now. But there are many other chile rellenos. I have a chile relleno in the cookbook that is actually a cold chile relleno, and it's a cold and pickled chile relleno. Wow. And it is a delight. And I have been wanting to make this since my first cookbook. And Rox Martin, who I'm so lucky to have had as an editor for all of my cookbooks, kept on telling me on cookbook one and cookbook two, I don't think America is ready for this one. And this year, you know, this book, I'm like, we are ready. So imagine a Mexican style Nisua salad stuffed in an exuberant fire roasted poblano chile. This is what this is like. So you take the fire roasted poblanos, which is, you know, it's a technique that's very simple to do. And then you make a marinade with oil and vinegar, and in that oil you cook onions and garlic and some spices. You marinate the chiles in that until they're slightly pickled, like the pickled jalapenos brine kind of. And you can make this ahead of time and put it in the fridge, and they will wait for you for weeks. And what I do is that when my husband comes home really late from work, which didn't happen throughout the pandemic because we've been locked in, but now that he's starting to go back to the office, and I'm like, no, don't go. But then when he comes back at, you know, very late hours of the day or the night, I just quickly make a tuna salad with, Mexicans love mayo. I don't know if people know, but, you know, tuna, mayo, lime juice, a little bit of celery, a little bit of onion. And you take out those pickled chiles, you stuff that with tuna. And I can't begin to describe the flavor of that.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Patty Heenich about her new cookbook called Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or your favorite Mexican food experiences. You can also find recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Patty Heenich from Patty's Mexican Table on PBS. She's got a new book, Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. Still time for your calls or Facebook comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page, your experiences, favorites, questions for Patty at 800-642-1234. Patty, we heard from Paul on Facebook who shared a great experience. Didn't say where, though. Says a quesadilla in a market was amazing. Stretchy cheese, fresh epazote and squash blossoms, and the tortillas made right on the spot. You mentioned that epazote earlier, Patty. Can you talk about that as a spice? You can use it. There's fresh and more available here, I think, dried.
Yeah, absolutely. And the quesadilla that he's sharing, that Paul is sharing, is a typical quesadilla that you find throughout Mexico and increasingly in the U.S., which is, I mean, which means you can find it, but not as much as Mexico, but at least you can find it and hopefully more and more. Epazote is a deeply Mexican herb. It is an herb that really defines us. It's very perfumed. It's very intense. It has a very deep, clean taste. It's the best way that I can describe it. You need to use it judiciously because it's that intense. And it's supposed to be a really good digestive, which is why many people cook their beans with epazote. And it's absolutely delicious with cheese in a quesadilla because it brings some kind of like fragrant aromatic. It's so hard to describe the taste, Rob, that you really have to try it. You can find the epazote herb increasingly in the U.S. And then if you learn to make your homemade corn tortillas, then you can be making those quesadillas anytime. Now, the blossom, the squash blossoms, which is so common in Mexico, it's much harder to find here. And in Mexico, it's much more accessible and price-wise, much more affordable. But I think we're going to get there.
I've used epazote, and I learned the hard way a little bit. It goes a long way with dried epazote. But I'll take your advice now and try it again.
Yeah, so epazote, yeah, you have to use it judiciously. So I would say if you're using the dried epazote, you need to use like 3 times the amount just because it's like very different in its fresh than its dried form. But it has a very unique taste. I love it.
Well, let's check out some dessert, Patty, because we're getting close to the end of our conversation. You've shared with us a classic creamy flan. That's definitely a dessert I think about when I think about Mexican food. Can you share a little bit of the story behind it?
Ah, yes. And flan, I mean, there's so many different kinds of flan. I was just now at the border, you know, aside from Patty's Mexican Table, this year I launched a new docu-series on Primetime with PBS and Amazon Prime. That's all about the borderlands. It's called La Frontera with Patty Jimich. And I went from El Paso, Ciudad Juarez, to Brownsville. And it was incredible. You know, the quality of food is just so phenomenal. And people think that along the Texas-US-Mexico border, you only find Tex-Mex. But you find phenomenal Mexican, you find phenomenal Texan, and you find these regional cuisine, these Tex-Mex cuisine, that's so different in the different parts of the Texas-Mexico border. And you realize that Tex-Mex food is so different at every spot. It's very different in El Paso from the Rio Grande Valley. And I'm connecting it to these raw because there were so many flan. and they were just absolutely extraordinary, from the round individual ones, which is like the creamy one I have in my new cookbook, which is like the flan that you crave for. It's the flan that you find in fondas. It's the flan that you find in, I would guarantee, any Mexican home. It's made with 4 or 5 ingredients, depending if you want to add more flavor or not. Like you can make it like I do here, or you can add some orange rind. But it's just very satisfying. It's satiating. It's after a Mexican meal, especially. It's creamy, it's mild, it's not incredibly sweet, and it's cold. So it's kind of refreshing and soothing.
And Patty, in just our last minute or so, can you leave us some inspiration for people to try cooking and try more variety of cooking inspired by Mexican food?
Yes. I just think that, you know, when you're cooking something new and you're trying something new, it's just a way to open a window to learn so many stories and to enrich your home, not only with a new food or dish, but really stories that can be shared and passed on. So I would recommend that when people hopefully get my cookbook, they find a dish or two that they want to try and begin with, and they'll realize that they're all approachable and easy. And I hope they will read the stories, and as they make the food, they will also share the stories.
Patty, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us again today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Patty Jimich, host of the PBS series Patty's Mexican Table. We listened back to a conversation from a few months ago about her newest book. It's called Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. We've posted a couple of recipes from her book over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Try out the ones we heard about there. Her green beans and corn sauce with pumpkin seeds. That sounds pretty good. If you're in the mood for dessert, the classic creamy flan. Both of those sound pretty good right now. If you give them a try, tell us how it goes. And by the way, while you're there, you can check out all of our past conversations on Food Friday. There is a wealth of great food and cooking advice there, and lots of recipes too. Maybe something you can make this weekend. And we're always looking for your ideas on future episodes of Food Friday. If there's a style of cooking or an ingredient or a technique or whatever that you want to learn more about on the air, we would love to hear about it and find somebody to answer your questions. You could let us know. Email centraltime@WPR.org. Again, that email is centraltime@WPR.org. You can always tweet us and follow us on Twitter. We are @centraltimewpr. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, it's the State Capitol Report. At the end of the legislative session, Kate will check in with leaders from both parties in Wisconsin's State Senate, looking at some of the big issues, what passed, what got put on the table maybe for future years, and how they're setting up for an election campaign. That's coming up Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Our news team is looking for some help from you. They're working on a piece on the ways that work and education have changed over the last 2 years during the pandemic, whether that involves remote work and remote learning or other changes. Their question for you, when it comes to education and work, what has changed for the long term and in what ways has it changed, do you think, for the foreseeable future? Or did things change and then snap back to normal? You can answer those questions online, maybe end up in their upcoming reporting. Go online to WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's like W-H-Y, Wisconsin. There's a link in the feed there where you can share your story about the changing world of work and school. While you're there, you could share a Wisconsin question that we could tackle on future episodes of Central Time. Again, answer that question about the changing world of work and education. Head over to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Helping out our reporters, this is Central Time.